Hello, I'm Hope McMath, director of the Kummer Museum of Art and Gardens in Jacksonville, Florida. If this is your first time listening, you can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes. It's easy to find. Just search Kummer Museum in the iTunes store. You can also find a link to all podcasts on our blog at blog.kummer.org/podcast.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming this evening. I am Susan Gallo, Director of Education here at the Kummer, and it is my distinct pleasure to introduce Elizabeth Hoyer to you. Elizabeth, we are proud to say, began her career here at the museum and went on to get a PhD from FSU and is now a professor at UNF. The Savage Collection came into the Kummer collection in 2007. It was a purchase from the descendants of Eugene Savage. And when we first got the collection, the artwork had to be conserved, and we also needed some scholarship done on the collection. So Elizabeth, with her American background, became our resident scholar for this, and she has done some wonderful work. There is a catalog that will be for sale in the gift shop shortly that is all about the Savage Collection. So I would like to turn things over to Elizabeth.
Thank you all for coming out. I've been told that I have to be chained to the podium in order for everybody to hear me over the mic, but I confess I'm actually a pacer. So I don't know how long I'm going to be able to chain myself here, but we'll see how it goes. I want to welcome you all, and hopefully everybody has had the opportunity to actually step into the Mason Gallery to see the seminal collection of paintings by Eugene Savage. They're an exciting group of works to have in the museum, and it's, from an art history standpoint, very exciting to see such a large collection within one museum, in addition to all of the sketches and the studies that go along with them. It is really, from that standpoint, an art historian's dream to have really the beginnings of an archive here. This is the first time these works have been exhibited since 1968, so we're very excited to have them back on display. And the works are so timely. They touch on issues of Native American rights. They touch on issues of conservation and environmentalism. They are, of course, of particular interest here in the state of Florida. So the subject matter is very topical. And they also come into issues of popular culture, with issues of tourism. And one of the other issues is that they provide me the opportunity to reassess the career of an artist who has not received the attention that I believe that he is due. Eugene Savage has had a very distinguished career as an artist, in particular as an American muralist, and the discovery of the rediscovery of the Savage paintings provides additional insight into his career, and I think will offer new insights into how his work should be perceived by future scholars. So I kind of see this as the door opening on the career of Eugene Savage again, and I think it's great that the Kummer Museum is involved in this. I want to start off talking a little bit about the background of Eugene Savage. A lot of people are not familiar with him, and I was familiar with him largely as a painter of decorative murals. That he, again, has a distinguished, a long and distinguished career. He was originally from Covington, Indiana, born in 1883. His father was a banker, died at a young age, and left Savage in the care of his mother. His mother would pass away when he was around 14 years old, and then Savage was taken care of by his siblings, his older sister. The one thing that he remembers about his mother, and the influence of his mother in particular, would be her love of classical music. And he would carry that passion with him throughout his life. And he would note that it was greatly influential on much of his later work. And that becomes also important in looking at some of the Savage seminal paintings. You see the influence of classical music, even in just the titles that he uses for these works. His education began briefly. He attended the Corcoran School of Art after graduating high school. And then around 1905, he would transfer to the Chicago Art Institute. And he would study there at night. During the day, he actually worked for an engraver. Shortly after that, around several years of that, he would get married. His wife, Matilda, was a physician, which is always a great thing to have when you're a struggling artist, have a wife as a doctor. And so she and he remained in Chicago until he was fortunate enough to eventually have won the very prestigious Prix de Rome. And the Prix de Rome actually opened a lot of doors for him. That was around 1912. And this scholarship sent him to Rome for 3 years. And in Rome, he had the opportunity to study the great masters of early Renaissance and the high Renaissance. He noted being particularly drawn to the 14th century and the 15th century. And he had the opportunity also at that point to study the methods and techniques of these artists. He wasn't simply interested in them from an art historical standpoint, but was particularly interested in learning how their works of art were made. And I brought in a couple of examples just to sort of give you a visual of the works that he was interested in. Small altars such as this from the 14th century, a Florentine painter, of course, Giotto's frescoes, Piero della Francesca as well. In looking at these works, he began to study the art of tempera painting, painting on panel. He developed an interest in fresco painting, and he was also drawn to the imagery. After his studies in Rome, he actually would return to the United States around 1915. He did not serve in World War I due to illness, and while he was in returning to the United States, he took on various teaching positions. As a sort of struggling artist, he worked as an adjunct as well as visiting instructor jobs at a number of different schools, prestigious schools, the Cooper Union, the City College in New York, also the Carnegie Institute, before he then would become inducted into the National Academy around 1924. And then also in 1924, he joined the faculty at Yale University. He was at Yale for 28 years. He was not only the professor of painting at the university, he would go on to be the dean of the college as well. And the influence on his students was profound. At the time period when most artists were starting to move towards, in America, move towards modernism and abstraction, he continued to teach his students in this very strong academic tradition, and he stressed the academic towards his students. He's sending an entire generation of art students out into the world. He would become particularly well known for sending them to Rome. And his disciples, as he would refer to them, would become nicknamed the Little Savages. Also following in his footsteps and all wanting to maintain this academic tradition of painting, even though the tide was turning in American art and there was a movement more towards the avant-garde and abstraction and more modernist movement. Throughout the 1920s and the 1930s, Savage began to build his career in creating a number of murals as well as sculptures. He works in a variety of different mediums. I brought in some early examples before we look at the seminal pieces to give you an idea of how his style actually changes once he arrives in Florida. So this is actually, it's titled The Bacchanal. It's the Four Seasons. It's located at the Indiana Museum. A work that he was perhaps most proud of was the commission that he received for the Elks Veterans Memorial in Chicago. He, in talking to his grandchildren, once noted how proud he was of this and also that that's where the big money came. Savage was responsible for painting the allegorical depictions that you see at the top, and he also painted one of the ceiling frescoes. Here's a detail of one of those paintings. Surprisingly, he also has worked in sculpture. This is the Bailey Fountain, which is located at the Grand Armory Plaza in Brooklyn. He did a number of murals for university, in particular for Yale University. This is by him from 1935 that he did for Columbia University. It is the allegorical figure of Columbia overcoming ignorance. Also in 1935, he began work on the paintings that he did for the Great Hall in Texas. And this was an exhibition of murals that were created featuring Texas history, and they were for the celebration of Texas at the 1935 exhibition. But for our interest, it's when he arrives in Florida, particularly traveling down to Miami. He comes down in 1935, actually, with his wife. And like all snowbirds, he comes down in January, escaping the winter, arriving in Miami, and he becomes interested in the Seminoles. The Seminoles at this time period had actually become quite the tourist draw in South Florida. They had recently become the subject of several newspaper articles that were looking into the plight of the Seminoles. And this is something that Savage becomes drawn to. The Seminoles were also the subject of a very popular book, The Seminoles of Florida, by Minnie Moore Wilson, a book of a lot of sort of questionable background information, but it was a bestseller, published, it went into reprint 4 or 5 times within just a period of about 6 years. So it was a very popular bestseller, and it had raised the profile of the Seminoles among the American public during this time period, the 1920s and into the early 30s. When Savage arrived in Florida, he became immediately aware of the circumstances in which the Seminoles were living. When he went to visit them, he visited them in commercial camps, and he was somewhat disappointed by this. He had a vision in his head of what Seminole life should be. He had a vision of this authentic, pristine, natural environment and the Seminoles living in harmony with nature. Instead, he arrived at commercial villages where Seminoles were put on display, where Seminoles were performing for tourists. Well, in order to understand how we got there, I want to do just a little bit of sort of quick background on the Seminoles. The Seminoles, of course, are not indigenous to Florida, but rather they are the descendants of the Creek, arriving in Florida as a result of several factors. In particular, the settling of colonists along the southeastern coast of North America drove the Seminoles, or excuse me, drove the Creeks southward, and then also the so-called Seminole Wars, which also pushed this group of Native Americans further into the Everglades as they were fleeing the U.S. Army. In South Florida, the Seminoles lived in relative isolation, having very little contact with white Americans. They essentially only came out for purposes of trade. This would change in the late 19th century, and it changed as development began to encroach into South Florida. As developers arrived right around 1880, there were a number of different projects and plans to drain South Florida and to drain the Everglades. The initial plans that were established in the 1880s were not terribly successful. It really wasn't until the first and second decades of the 20th century that we see the very successful draining and development of the area of the Everglades. And this was driven in part by Governor Napoleon Bonaparte Broward, who actually ran on the slogan, "Drain the Everglades." So he was rallying people behind him for this purpose. Draining the glades was creating more land, obviously, more real estate opportunities, and also more farmland and cattle land for cattle ranchers in the South also. So there were a multitude of economic reasons for pushing these ideas. I brought in a couple examples of the Everglades land sales posters. The Drain Everglades state legislatures all agree great area must be reclaimed was actually the newspaper headline at the time period. A really sort of, I think, very telling image of Seminole pulling a dugout canoe past one of these billboard signs which were advertising land for sale. The impact of development in South Florida would have a very profound effect on Seminole culture. First, you have the change of waterways. As the water levels went down, Seminoles were no longer able to travel through particular hunting sites. You had changes in migratory patterns of birds. You had timber companies coming in and clear-cutting cypress, mahogany, and pine. These destroyed the traditional canopies where Seminoles had established their villages. So they were displaced from their traditional home sites. You also had sportsmen coming in and decimating entire species, decimating and destroying rookeries. So the bird population is wiped out. Alligators hunting the deer in the area. So the Seminoles were left on the verge of starvation, not able to hunt, not able to gain access to foods that they had traditionally hunted. They sought refuge. And they sought refuge in one of the only ways that was available to them at the time period. And those were the commercial villages that began to emerge. Various entrepreneurs, among them Coppinger's Tropical Gardens, Musa Isle, Indian Village, probably one of the most infamous was the Osceola Indian Village. These were commercial villages that sprang up in response to tourism. The entrepreneurs recognized that the tourists had an interest, an appetite in Seminole culture, and how better to bring it to them than to set up these artificial tourist villages. Put the Seminoles on display. Now, the Seminoles were allowed to come and go. They saw this as an opportunity to find refuge. During difficult times, struggling for survival in the Everglades, they would come to the villages, they could trade hides, they could make a little money selling handcrafts, and then once they had managed to build up enough resources, they could return to the Everglades. So they weren't a captive audience. And their participation in the commercial village was on their own accord. It was purely voluntary. They were not forced to stay there. A couple of photos that I brought in here, the selling of Seminole patchwork, the very distinctive clothing that you see in the savage paintings of the Seminole patchwork. The patchwork develops in these tourist camps. And it becomes much more fanciful, much more elaborate with bold patterning and colors in the camps because it attracts the tourists. They learn very quickly that the tourists are drawn to this, so they give the audience what they want. The patchwork also comes about, of course, with the introduction of sewing machines that were brought in by traders at the turn of the century. They also had, in addition to the selling of palmetto dolls, sweetgrass baskets, but it was the spectacle and the performance that, in particular, Savage noted, bothered him a great deal. Performances such as Seminole weddings, which were put on, again, to entertain curious tourists. It became somewhat comical because they often married the same couple every year. You also had the alligator wrestlers. Alligator wrestling is sort of sport emerged initially. The sons of one of the commercial villages jumped into a pit and wrestled an alligator. They soon figured out that this was a lucrative performance, that it attracted crowds. So then the Seminoles began to take on this sport as well. And they would perform this as tourists would toss money into the pit. So this is the environment that Savage comes into when he arrives in the Everglades. And this is how he initially experiences Seminole culture. And it does not live up to his expectations. He decides that he would actually prefer to travel outside of the camps. Now, I've got some photographs, and we've been very fortunate recently to actually have an opportunity to see some of the photographs that Eugene Savage actually took. These are his images. So it gives you an idea of what he's looking at, and then it becomes wonderful resource material to actually then compare to his paintings. So you can see what he's drawing from and what he's seeing, and then also how he is reinterpreting it for the audience. These are two photographs, again, one of the villages in the back, and this is a great photograph. It's a view of the spectacle of tourism. And one of the things that has always sort of fascinated me about tourism and its effect on the arts is how many artists go and examine other cultures but don't consider themselves tourists. They consider themselves to be these enlightened observers. And the tourists then are sort of those crass commercial people that are doddering about looking at something that perhaps they don't fully appreciate or understand. So it's interesting to see him taking photographs of this group of tourists that have gathered about as a woman is sitting and she's making palmetto dolls. And even though you can't see into her lap, you can see that right under here are some of the forms for palmetto dolls. So she is busy making the materials, the objects that then would be sold as souvenirs to the tourists. Here, taking photographs of children walking across the camp. And there are a number of really striking photographs that he takes, close-up representations or depictions of the women and their hairstyles. I wish it came out a little bit better, but when you see these in person, you can actually see the hairnet that holds the roll in place. The hair is rolled up like a visor over the forehead. So the hairnet is easily visible. And here you can see, I think, a number of the body pins that hold the hair all in place. Very few of his photographs actually show elements of modernity. You notice the woman sitting there, you didn't see her sitting at a sewing machine working. And this is one of the rare photographs that he has that actually has a telephone pole in the background. But when you look at a lot of photographs that were coming out of South Florida at this time period, you would actually see the juxtaposition of the modern with the so-called primitive. You would see the image of the Seminole in a canoe along the Tamiami Trail and then a car behind them. Or you would see a photograph of the Seminoles and they would be looking up at an airplane flying through the sky. So a lot of the tourist imagery that was coming out of this time period was calling attention to the striking difference between them and us. He hired a Seminole guide. And there are actually photographs of him with his guide. We don't have full access to all of those photographs yet, but I have seen these, so I attest to it. A photograph of him and his guide has taken him out into the Everglades. He hired somebody to take him out so that he could see other campgrounds, so that he could perhaps see a more pristine view of the Everglades. But it's interesting what he turns his attention to. Here, the droughts. The drainage caused droughts, which then caused widespread forest fires across the Everglades, which added to the decimation of resources for the Seminoles. So the burned out canopies. And then, of course, the dredge equipment. There are a number of photographs that he includes that feature the dredge equipment. Now, using his photographs as well as collecting postcards, and that's sort of the fun thing of going through his archive, is that you get to see all of the material that he brings together. And the images and the material that he collects, he returns to New York. He doesn't do any of his studies here. He gathers the material, he returns to his studio in New York, and he essentially spends the year of 1935 creating the first 14 paintings. And as he is creating these, he is very aware of the ongoing debates that are raging in government, in particular the debates over the so-called Seminole problem. By the 1930s, the defenders of Seminole culture were growing increasingly concerned about the deculturation of the Seminole tribe, wanting to preserve their traditions. So they were seeking land for the Seminoles to live on so that they could try to preserve as much of their tradition and not have to participate in the commercial tourist camps for survival. Among those that were supporting, and I have a couple photographs, Harriet Bedell, who was a missionary who helped the Seminoles. Also, anthropologist Ethel Cutler Freeman also did a number of studies examining how modern society was transforming and changing Seminole culture, and not necessarily for the better. Their desire to protect and preserve Seminole culture clashed with environmentalist and conservationist efforts. This is a photograph of Ernest Coe, who's known as the father of the Everglades. Coe sought for the preservation of the Everglades, and he sought for the removal of the Seminoles from the Everglades. He did not believe that the Everglades should have individuals living on it, particularly individuals that would use the resources. The Everglades was to be a protected site for wildlife as well as for plant life. So to have the Seminoles continue to live on that land to him was highly problematic. So he called for the removal of the Seminoles and then the voiding of their rights to this land that they had essentially been pushed onto. So this was a very heated debate at the time period, which is how it becomes known as the Seminole problem, is how then to deal with this issue, the conservationist efforts on one part to make the Everglades a national park, or the preservation of a people that will essentially be destroyed if they could, their culture be destroyed if not severely damaged by the removal from this site. Savage followed these debates very closely. He collected a number of newspaper articles, particularly those related to the visit of John Collier, who was the Director of Indian Affairs, and Harold Ice, who was the Secretary of the Interior. They traveled down to the Everglades in March of 1935, so the same year that Eugene Savage had traveled in. He was there in January and February, and then right after him, you had Ice and Collier come in. And they sided with the Native Americans as far as, at that time period, they came out in favor of protecting Native rights and not removing the Seminoles from the Everglades. However, Ernest Coe would be very persistent, and he would continually bombard the government with numerous letters arguing for the removal of the Seminoles. So it would continue to be a debate throughout the 40s and into the 50s. With the debates at hand and with the material in hand, he began work on this series of paintings. The original series is comprised of 14 works. We don't have all of those 14 works. I'm looking for them. So if you see something familiar and you're in the next couple months or years, let me know. But this is the original checklist, and I'm showing this to you because it also allows us to see how Savage intended this group of 14 to be seen. And when you go into the Mason Gallery, that first room that you walk into features the works associated with the original 14, and then the second half of the gallery has the later works from the 40s and then the 50s. So this is his original brochure for the Farragill Gallery when these were exhibited in 1936, so roughly a year after he created them. And you can see the titles here, Heritage Primeval, A Garden of Eden in Florida Everglades, A Paradise of Fish and Game and Wildlife. And you can read through, the language is really sort of interesting. Holocaust, then fire swept through their paradise. Orchid Trail, number 8, Fanciful Women in Gondolas. At the top, the women were like a Byzantine empress and the men like papal guards. The titles were supplied by Eugene Savage. So you can see how he is seeing his works, that they are not simply representations of the Seminoles. Now, I brought in sort of references to the original 14, so you can see how this unfolds. The first one is the Heritage Primeval. We have the watercolor, which is on exhibition in the gallery. The painting, it's a little dark, but this is actually at the Rhode Island Institute of Design, and it was actually purchased from the initial show. So that is where this one is located. Here you see the family making their way into the swamps of the Everglades. You can make out the Bochiki in the background. But it sets this tone of this movement of this family along the journey. And as their journey unfolds in the next scene, Lakes Without Water, is where you begin to see our artist is very clearly making a very critical commentary on this so-called development and progress in South Florida. He includes then the photograph that we saw of the dredge equipment. In the background, you see the rays of light coming up through the clouds. It can be seen as the rising sun for the progress and development. It can also obviously be seen as the setting sun, the end of a culture. And as the Seminoles glide through the side, you see the reaction with the looming dredging equipment overhead, sort of this monstrous arm reaching down, and the family fleeing off to the side in addition with the bird, the wildlife also. As the series unfolds, Holocaust is next. And I've always sort of been struck for his use of the term Holocaust, because when we think of the Holocaust, obviously we think of the atrocities of World War II, but this predates that. So he's making reference to the biblical concept of Holocaust, a sacrifice by fire. So here the family flees through the Everglades. The deer flee as well as the other wildlife, the birds overhead. And Savage actually had intimate knowledge of the fires in the Everglades. He noted that as he was moving through the Everglades with his Seminole guides, that they were actually trapped by wildfire. And they were barely able to make their escape by moving into a pool of water, so narrowly escaping the flames. So one wonders if the memory of that experience also becomes part of the inspiration for this painting. As the series moves on, you see that the family now is at their campsite, but their chiki, the traditional Seminole housing, has been destroyed by fire. The remnants of the campfire at the base, the palm trunks that would have been used as the support there as well. And then the reaction of the father sitting to the side, the mother's obviously very emotional reaction, and then the children sort of questioning and pleading. Overhead, of course, the vulture becomes a symbol that he includes in a number of his works in this series for its symbolism as sort of a harbinger of death. As the family moves along, this is Gaunt Tamarack, which is sort of an interesting title. If you know your Everglades trees, tamaracks do not grow in the Everglades. Obviously, we have a northerner here that is trying to make reference to a tree similar to the tamarack. And of course, what you have here are cypresses. But as the family moves along, you see that there's no longer two children, but there's simply one. The bed tree overhead, mimicking the body of the Seminole mother. So that sort of broken form. And again, the vulture bearing down on her and her hair undone. This would be a traditional sign of mourning for a woman to have unrolled her hair to the side. And I'll call back up the photographs that he took. I think probably one of the most striking works is Biscayne Holiday. And this painting really is at the center of this series of 14. And as you look at these, hopefully you're seeing, obviously, not just the narrative, but you're seeing the mural artist with Savage. And one of the things that's been exciting that we discovered with the cleaning of these works is that the works are actually mounted on aluminum, which leads us to believe that perhaps the series was, in fact, originally intended to be a mural that was never actually put into whatever site he had hoped it would be acquired by. And I remind you, we're in the 1935-1936, the height of the WPA. There is a post office down in Miami that had a mural being installed at the same time period. So it is quite possible that that was the original intent for that group of 14. But this is the climactic image that he creates, and it's definitely one of the most striking. It's an allegorical image of a Seminole mother cradling her child. But of course, if you look very closely, the child is dead. She stands with her eyes closed, and she is then surrounded by the chaos of South Florida, this tourist environment. Off to the side, you have the figures that would be looking over the wall into the alligator pit, and then our alligator wrestler off to the side also. She is surrounded by bathing beauties down at the bottom, two diving to the side, and then you can also see the diving board at the top with the little fanny off one end and their shoes draped off the other end. I wanted to flip through some of the studies. Some of the watercolors are on view for you, but the charcoal studies aren't. And it gives us a really great opportunity to see how Savage is working as an artist. Here are some of the charcoal studies that he creates. And you can see how he is moving through and making decisions about the placement of the figure and how he wants the composition to come together, moving the Seminole mother and child in different one side of the image to the other. Does he place emphasis on the alligator wrestler, or does he de-emphasize the alligator wrestler? Do the bathing beauties demand sort of front center stage? He continues to work through these issues with the watercolors as he develops them. And one of the things about Savage is that the number of different sources that he pulls inspiration from. Remember, he's got his photographs, he's got his postcards, but he also looks in the newspaper. It was fun to find this in his archive material. And it's actually a page out of the New York newspaper that covers a diving competition. So he uses the figure, the diver here, sort of stop action photography moving through space. And it becomes then a source that he references for his diving girls off to the side. The alligator wrestler, in addition to photographing numerous images of one of the Seminoles wrestling an alligator, he also gained access to a baby alligator. And he photographed it from every different position imaginable. His photographs of the Seminole mother and child. And then, of course, we see those alongside Seminole Nation Holds Mother's Day in Florida, a postcard that you'll find in his collection of cards from South Florida. But you also have to look to and remember his background and his knowledge. And I, of course, brought in the Cummers of Madonna of Humility to give you a comparison of the mother and child is, of course, also drawing from the Madonna and child imagery. And if we come back to this scene, she stands here holding a dead child. Now, we, of course, know in our history, the Madonna and child, the infant Christ, is not shown as dead. But it becomes a reference back to the Pietà, a famous sculpture by Michelangelo, cradling the body of her dead adult son, here rendered as a child. And there's sort of a precedence for this. I wish I had brought it in as I'm talking about it. Madonna of the Long Neck, which was by Parmigiano Nino. I say that as Dr. Murphy's here cringing. Which would have been a very important sort of visual source for him that he certainly would have been aware of. And as we look at this image, you notice there are figures to the side. Well, these would be tourists in their straw-brimmed caps. But look how they have morphed, as if they were angels with the flat plate halos that we associate with altar panels. And then as we look more closely, we even have this sort of loose suggestion of a Last Judgment scene, of figures on one side rising, figures falling, and then in the corner, of course, the man wrestling with this frightening reptile, the alligator. It's a wonderful painting that really sort of sums up all of the issues that he is thinking about at the time period, the commercialization of Seminole culture and the sacrifice of Seminoles for the backdrop that you see of Miami, which springs up with the pink hotels and the palm trees. And we return to our exhibition listing here. Let's see, where are we here? 15 Holiday. And then as we continue on, South Moon Under, you see that his paintings change after Biscayne Holiday. They become more sort of serene depictions of the Seminoles within the Everglades. So he's made a shift here in his subject matter. South Moon Under, I think we can draw clear associations to Marjorie Killing Rawlings' book, South Moon Under at the time period. And what's really great in one of the small studies that we actually have in the museum is there's actually text written to the side, Clomocea, which we've been working with some of our seminal experts. We've been able to decipher one word that means sort of calm or still water. On the other side, Orchid Hunter, Orchid Pavilion. Savage, while he was in the villages and in interviews, he noted that he did pay Seminole models. However, he would likely not have paid Seminole women to actually pose in various states of undress. So I think you have to remember that this is sort of the academic tradition of the artist and the classical nude coming through as opposed to a scandalous depiction of Seminole women on display for the tourist gaze. The image that follows on the list, Orchid Pavilion, is a painting that is titled Holowagus. And I think it is interesting that it comes after this particular painting. We don't know where it is, so what we're working with are charcoal drawings. But here is the depiction, and I note this concept of Holowagus in the gallery, and it's a subject or a theme that he comes to a number of times. And what it essentially refers to, it loosely translates no good, and it was a word that was part of their folklore. In the 1920s and the 1930s, it becomes a popularized folk that discusses women who have sexual relations with white men are labeled holowagas. And the children can often be punished for the crime of the mother, and a woman will be sent off as punishment into the Everglades with nothing but a knife and a canoe to survive for the duration of her sentence. And there are a number of images within the series that you'll find that sort of have reference to this concept of banishment or this concept of holowagas. So again, Savage was fascinated by the folklore, in addition to some of the social issues. The Hunter, again, this is a drawing from one of the paintings that we're actually missing. The last in the series, one of the watercolors that we have, of Meekin Seeking Moon. Now, as the series unfolds, you see it goes from this state of the devastation of Seminole culture, because of the development in the so-called progress of white culture coming into South Florida. You have the Biscayne Holiday as the centerpiece, and then the second half of this series, you see the Seminoles living in harmony and balance, and you see an emphasis on their traditions within the Everglades. I think one of the things that Savage was actually doing here was speaking to the Seminoles association and their ties to the land and their rights as the true caretakers of the Everglades. Something that he would note in a quote is that white man had been the demise of their culture, but we could learn from how they take care of their land, that they don't overhunt, that they're careful with their resources, and that they live in harmony and balance with their natural surroundings. In talking about them, I also wanted to make note of the style that Eugene Savage develops. He noted that when he went to Florida, his style changed. He was struck by the patterns, the colorful patchwork patterns that he saw on the clothing. And he begins to incorporate those colors into his palette, so his palette becomes much more bright. And he also begins to incorporate the patterning. You see a rhythm in Savage's paintings at this time period. And even if you look at the cypress knees to the side here, the body of the woman sort of mimics the shape of the cypress knee. The emphasis on the stripes on the canoe. The painting style that he's developing is taking on a much more modern style. He sees the Seminoles as an opportunity to start to experiment with modernism. And like a lot of artists at this time period, he's experimenting with modernism and using concepts of primitivism, drawing from what he sees as patterns, the designs, the rhythms that he sees in traditional Native American art forms, and he draws inspiration from those and incorporates those into his own painting. But that's not his only influence. He drew from so many sources. He was also greatly inspired by Japanese art, something that he would deny right around the time period of World War II. He shifted that to, I was greatly influenced by Chinese art. But I think you can see, particularly with his slanted perspective, and in particular with his representations of cranes and egrets, they're very reminiscent of a lot of woodblock Japanese prints. So he's an interesting artist in the number of different fields that he draws inspiration from. The one label I'm not particularly comfortable with when it comes to Savage is the Art Deco label. We have a tendency, because we're in Florida, he's in Miami, there is a tendency to want to associate him with Art Deco. And Art Deco, the term itself, didn't come about really until 1968. And I think it's a problematic term for a number of reasons. But also, I think it's part of the reason why Savage has not received the amount of attention that I think he deserves. Deco, of course, implies the decorative. And it suggests that his works are without substance, that they are without social content. And I think it's very obvious that his works are very much in the tradition at this time period of engaging the styles or the movement of social realism. He's grappling with this particular political issue at the time period. Another influence I wanted to mention, and I wanted to show you this as well, he did a fellowship actually at the Maestlin Research Studio, which was an arts colony studio established down in Maitland, Florida. And it would become an important center for artists to come and to experiment with new types of modernism. And while he's there, he actually creates this little drawing. It was in 1955. Here you see a self-portrait, Savage seated at his easel, alligator off to the side, but also take note of the music. The music's always an influence on him. And this again gets back to the issue of modernism. So many modern artists were drawing inspiration or using music as a means to experiment and to employ abstraction in their art. And he begins to title, particularly these later works, which are so serene and so calm and so peaceful. There's no more fire, there's no more famine, there's no more death and devastation. Instead, what you have are these very, very quiet scenes of hunting, again, bow and arrow. Notice no rifle. And of course, the Seminoles are using rifles at this time period. So he has this depiction of the Seminoles. He wants to represent them according to this authentic vision that he has and that he has in his mind. And also that I think he thinks his viewer has as well, an expectation of them. But he titles his works things like Largo, Caprice, Scherzo. Here, this is Caprice. This is Scherzo. These are all titles that have musical associations to them. So he's suggesting here, of course, the influence of music as he is creating these works of art, drawing inspiration. Scherzo is a movement that is a very quick, fast-paced movement. And you get a sense of that then with this depiction of the Seminole woman moving very quickly, the wind whipping the Spanish moss, which almost sort of takes on these sort of ghost-like forms up in the trees. This quick movement of the bird as it sort of startles from the Everglades and leaps up into the air. I hope this lecture has given you some insights into the work of Eugene Savage and the complexity of them. They are paintings that are not, by any means, documents of Seminole culture. They are one man's perception and vision of the Seminoles. And he starts off with a very, very strong political view and a lot of commentary in them. And his works are, I think, an ongoing commentary on the plight of the Seminoles and the devastation of progress and their rights and their place within the Everglades. So I hope that you will enjoy the exhibition. If you have any questions, please feel free to ask. And I'll also go into the galleries if anybody has any questions they'd like to talk about personally with me. But I thank you all for coming.